Welcome to Mysteries, Myths, and More. I'm your narrator, Joyce Keller Walsh. My intention is to use this podcast to tell a story each month, sometimes fiction, sometimes not, that I hope you'll find interesting, engaging, and provocative.
Episode number 23, part 1, April 2024. It can't happen here. Part 1, I saw Hitler. I was reading a biography of author Sinclair Lewis by Mark Shore because I remembered reading Lewis's book, It Can't Happen Here, many years ago, and I was interested in writing something about it. Although I'd been an undergraduate English major with a concentration in American studies, it was a lot I didn't know about Harry Sinclair Lewis, including his first name, Hal, to his friends. I didn't know that in 1926, he'd been the first person to refuse the Pulitzer Prize, ostensibly because, he said, he didn't believe in such contests that place one author or one book over another. By 1930, though, he apparently changed his mind because he was the first American author to receive the Nobel Prize in Literature. Didn't know that either. By 1930, he'd written, among other novels, the bestsellers Main Street in 1920, Babbitt in 1922, Arrowsmith in 1925, Elmer Gantry in 1927, and Dodsworth in 1929, all of which were made into Hollywood movies with celebrity actors and directors, and there were many more novels to come. Born in Minnesota in 1885, Lewis is described as a ginger-haired, homely young boy, studious but not very athletic. His Welsh father was a doctor who remarried shortly after Lewis's mother died, when the boy was only 6. Although Lewis was educated in Yale and traveled in upper-class social circles, many, if not most, of his novels have a Midwestern middle-class ethos which outsold his literary contemporaries such as Faulkner, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and other notables. But because American literature and American society has changed in the past 100 or so years, Sinclair Lewis's novels have not held up all that well. While a successful and extraordinarily prolific novelist, short story writer, and playwright, he had a very rocky personal life, due in great measure to his alcoholism, which contributed to his death in 1951. It likely also contributed to his 2 divorces. Biographer Shore presents the writer as both likable and dislikable according to how much Lewis was drinking. Lewis's first marriage to Grace Livingston Hager, an editor at Vogue magazine, lasted about 11 years, ending in divorce. His second marriage to journalist Dorothy Thompson lasted from 1928 to 1942 and was fraught with ups and downs, also ending in divorce. It was she, in my opinion, who influenced his 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here. Without Dorothy Thompson, this dystopian story might never have been written. As often happens in research, I found myself branching off from Sinclair Lewis to learn more about Dorothy Thompson. Here again, I learned so much that I hadn't known before. For instance, that according to the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum, she was one of America's most urgent and eloquent voices against Nazism. Her writing and radio broadcasts alerted millions of people to Nazi Germany's persecution of Jews, as well as the threat it posed to democracy and international peace. Born in upstate New York in 1893, Thompson, like Lewis, lost her mother at an early age. Like Lewis, Thompson's Methodist minister father soon remarried. But unlike Lewis, who cared for his new stepmother, Thompson and her new stepmother did not get along. Because of that, the young girl was removed from her New York home to live with aunts in Chicago. There she attended Lewis Institute and obtained an associate's degree, after which she transferred to Syracuse University, where she graduated cum laude in 1914, a time, over a century ago, when not many women went to college. She subsequently became involved in the suffrage movement, did some writing for New York publications, and in 1920 left for London to become a foreign correspondent and to pursue a journalism degree. From the beginning, Thompson had a stunning career, interviewing newsworthy subjects like Sinn Féin's Irish independence leader, Terence McSweeney. From there, she was assigned to Vienna by the Philadelphia Public Ledger, where she became fluent in German. Her knowledge of the German language was to lead her down another path, because she then became the head of the New York Post's Berlin Bureau, just as the Nazi Party was ascendant. In 1923, Thompson married her first husband, Hungarian writer Joseph Bard. That apparently unhappy marriage lasted 4 years and was finished days before she met Sinclair Lewis at Chancellor Gustav Stresemann's weekly press conference in Berlin. Lewis continued to propose to Thompson for nearly a year until she finally accepted, and on May 14, 1928, they were married. Thompson was no revolving planet around his bright sun. While Lewis was famous in America and Europe, Thompson was also very well known on both continents for her reportage. In fact, she was to become cited as the first lady of American journalism. In 1932, as a representative of the Saturday Evening Post, Thompson finally secured the interview she'd been pursuing for 7 years, a sit-down with Germany's political leader and soon-to-be-appointed Chancellor Adolf Hitler. Why him? Because, as Thompson writes, by 1930, it is impossible any longer to laugh off Hitler. The country is in bad shape. The idea of a dictatorship is running wild. On the day of the interview, she expects to meet not a little political leader, but a probable dictator, a man who owns an army, a man who terrorizes the streets, a man who predicts the constitution of a new, dangerous, and awakened Germany. As she waited for an hour in the Kaiserhof Hotel for Hitler to appear, she admits to being nervous. Thompson writes in her 1932 book, I Saw Hitler, that she was convinced that she was going to be in the presence of the future dictator of Germany. But within the first minute of the interview, she writes that, quote, I was quite sure that I was not. Thompson found Hitler ill-poised and insecure and the very prototype of the little man. Conversation with him was difficult, she reports, because he spoke as though he were addressing a mass meeting. A hysterical note creeps into his voice, which rises sometimes almost to a scream. On the subject of the Constitution, Hitler was more explicit, though there again, she writes, I had to interrupt an address to an unseen gallery. I will get into power legally, he told Thompson. I will abolish this parliament and Weimar Constitution afterward. I will found an authority state, from the lowest cell to the highest instance. Everywhere there will be responsibility and authority above, discipline and obedience below. Imagine, she writes, a would-be dictator setting out to persuade a sovereign people to vote away their rights. In the foreword, Thompson writes that for program, he had a mixture of fascism, racialist philosophy that teaches Aryans, and especially Nordics, are created to rule the earth, antisemitism, and muddled socialism. But he has an audience, a vast audience, already prepared. It is the audience of the patriotic, offended, middle-class mob. Hitler is not naive about the power of the spoken word to persuade an audience. Thompson quotes Hitler's writing in Mein Kampf, translated as My Struggle, published in 1925. One must judge a public speech not by the sense it makes to the scientists who read it the next day, but by the effect which it has on the masses. And the function of speech-making is not the telling of truth. Thompson concludes that he does not shrink from lying. It will serve a purpose, nor the advancing of a lie. However, she writes, Hitler and his Nazis can come to power by themselves only if they can get control of 51% of the Reichstag seats. And no matter how you look at it, this eventuality seems, at present, unlikely. Thompson's interview first appeared in Cosmopolitan magazine and was then turned into a book. The book is small, only 80-some pages, of which half is annotated photos of prominent German political leaders. At the end of the text, she writes, I predict that Hitler will be extinguished between two prelates. By this, she evidently means the current president, Paul von Hindenburg, and the current chancellor of the German Republic, Dr. Heinrich Brüning. What Thompson couldn't foresee is that Hindenburg would appoint Hitler chancellor in 1933 after Brüning resigned his chancellorship the previous May. Upon learning that Hindenburg was dying in 1934, which he ultimately did in August, Hitler abolished the office of president and merged these powers with those of chancellor, making Hitler the Führer. Despite noting the rabid anti-Jewish rhetoric of Hitler, neither Thompson nor perhaps anyone could realize the Holocaust to come. But Thompson didn't let her book be the end of her writing about Hitler. More and more she became aware of the terrible nature of his power, and more she spoke out about it in her writing and on the radio, to such a degree that in August of 1934, after the death of Hindenburg and seizing of power by the Führer, she became the first American journalist to be expelled from Germany by the Gestapo for her negative reports about Hitler. Thompson saw the urgency of her writing about Nazism because, as she put it, quote, "the times in which we live move too fast for the considered historian to record them for us. They move too quickly to permit the writing of long books about momentary phases. Ours is the age of the reporter." And so it was. Returning home, Dorothy Thompson became impassioned about the rising antisemitism and fascism in the United States. The climate of right-wing groups in her home country that embraced totalitarianism and Nazism in the 1930s, she saw as a fundamental threat to democracy. Just how significant these fascistic movements in America were is thoroughly documented in the 2023 book Prequel by Rachel Maddow. In summation, Thompson writes, "No people ever recognize their dictator in advance. If anyone turned up here in a fur hat, boots, and a grim look, he would be recognized and shunned. But when our dictator shows up, you can depend on it that he will be one of the boys, and he will stand for everything traditionally American." Both Stalin in Russia and Mussolini in Italy had been in power for about 10 years when Thompson wrote her book, and she would have been well aware who and what they were. But it may be that in 1932, when her book was published, Thompson had in mind a homegrown authoritarian, Governor Hugh Long of Louisiana. Long was governor from 1928 to 1932, at which time he was elected senator from that state. He served until his assassination in September 1935, while he was preparing to run for president against incumbent Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Long began his career as one of the boys, that is, a populist fighting for the betterment of conditions for the southern poor in his state. Indeed, he appears to have improved many conditions, services, and infrastructure Louisiana during his tenure. However, as the cliche goes, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. As time went on, Long accrued power and wealth to himself and followed the maxim, do good to your friends and harm to your enemies. The practical achievements that Long was able to accomplish happened, Rachel Maddow writes, because he effectively did away with any checks and balances on his own power to rule. He brought the whole state of Louisiana under the control of his political machine. He took control of all the elections in the state, also all appointed offices. He stacked every level of state government and even local government with people who answered only to him. He used bribes and threats to simply take anything he wanted, including from the state legislature. He ran Louisiana like a mob boss. There have been many movies and TV programs about the kingfish, Huey Long, if you want to know more. One of Long's economic programs was called Share the Wealth, which guaranteed every family $5,000 annual income, over $100,000 in today's dollars, from the federal government, among other economic benefits to the public. It didn't happen. But this promise will feature in Sinclair Lewis's novel, as we'll hear in part two of this episode. Meanwhile, the 1930s in America saw the rise of fascism and pro-Nazi pockets of true believers in anti-Semitism and racism. America had the precedent from the Founding Fathers on down for believing that white Christian males were the natural inheritors of the nation. This belief took hold in Germany and went down a skewed evolutionary path when the Nazis in 1935 passed the, quote, "law for the protection of German blood and German honor," unquote. This law forbade marriage between Jews and German citizens and was followed by a second law quote, "stripped Jews of German citizenship and all political rights." These so-called laws were just a progression of Hitler's earliest intent, as expressed in Mein Kampf, where he writes, "such mating," that is between species, and meaning between races, contradicts the will of nature towards the selective improvements of life in general. The favorable preliminary to this improvement is not to make individuals of higher and lower orders of being, but rather to allow the complete triumph of the higher order. The stronger must dominate and not mate with the weaker, which would signify the sacrifice of its own higher nature. Only the born weakling can look upon this principle as cruel, and if he does so, it is merely because he is of a feebler nature and narrower mind. For if such a law did not direct the process of evolution, then the higher development of organic life would not be conceivable at all. And he goes on, the struggle between the various species did not arise from a feeling of mutual antipathy, but rather from hunger and love. In both cases, nature looks on calmly and is even pleased with what happens. The struggle for the daily livelihood leaves behind in the ruck everything that is weak or diseased or wavering, while the fight of the male to possess the female gives to the strongest the right, or at least the possibility, to propagate its kind. And this struggle is a means of furthering the health and powers of resistance in the species. Thus, it is one of the causes underlying the process of development towards a higher quality of being. Antisemitism found a home in the thinking and propaganda not only of Hitler, but also in a number of fifth columnists in the United States, including such prominent radio broadcasters as the popular Catholic priest, Brother Charles Coughlin, and the most famous American antisemite, Henry Ford, the automobile magnate in the 1920s and onward. Ford promoted his hatred of Jews through his newspaper and through the distribution of the false protocols of the meetings of the learned elders of Zion internationally. According to Maddow, in 1931, a reporter from the Detroit News found hanging on the wall behind Hitler's desk a large framed portrait of America's most famous antisemite. I regard Henry Ford as my inspiration, Hitler explained to the newswoman, Annetta Halliday Antona. Hitler, in 1933, had sent one of his acolytes to organize Nazi groups all along the Pacific coast, called the Friends of the New Germany, to defeat the country's two greatest enemies, Jews and communists. A year later, in 1934, after Dorothy Thompson was expelled from Germany, her husband Sinclair Lewis began writing his cautionary novel, It Can't Happen Here. And he took a cue from Thompson's message that an American dictator would be homegrown. I'll talk about Sinclair Lewis's novel in my following podcast.
If you like this podcast, please download and subscribe. It's free, and you'll find it on your favorite directories such as Apple, Google, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more. To learn more about me and my books, go to joycewalsh.com.